Good evening. So we're going to be, I've got about 2 weeks left, I think, of the study on New Testament apologetics, Christian apologetics, call it what you will. Whoever's next, at least you have a little bit of a warning. So a couple of things I wanted to talk about as we get rolling here. I have several books that I use that I kind of keep in my library in one way, shape, or form. One of these is called Investigating Christian Evidences. It's really pretty good. Covers a lot of stuff. Creation, evolution, some New Testament apologetic stuff. This is actually from Bert Thompson and Brad Harab. They're Church of Christ guys. Apologetics Press, who puts that out. It's a really good one. This is an interesting one. I don't remember. This was a gift, actually. I don't remember who bought it for me. But it's called The Questions Christians Hope No One Will Ask. And with answers. It's easy to list the questions. The answers are the tough part. Pretty good. It's kind of a, like a note card approach. So here's a question and here's a whole bunch of answers. It's pretty good. I don't find it as in-depth as a lot of the other ones, but it's a very good introduction. This is probably one of the best ones if you can find it. It's called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. It's by Josh McDowell. Very, very good book. Very well written, very thoroughly researched, and very well referenced. Lots of great stuff in there, way more than simply the New Testament, but a very useful book in that regard. This is another one. I think I got this at one of the family camps. The Scientific Case for Christianity. It's not necessarily New Testament specific related, but it's pretty interesting in its own right. Probably one of the best handbooks that I've ever seen for the whole idea of Christian apologetics is this one. It is the Holman Quick Source Guide to Christian Apologetics by Doug Powell. If you like pictures, there's lots of them. But it's very, very well done. This is also available if you have the Olive Tree Bible app. The whole book is also available there as well. I have it on my phone. I think it's like $15 for the electronic version. I think this one's about... Yeah, it says $14.99 on the back too, so it's about $15. Most of these, most of those are about in that realm. So not expensive, really, really good resources. Provide a lot of information, probably a lot more than, obviously a lot more than I'm going to cover and or have covered. But really, really good sources if you want to dig a little bit further. So tonight, I want to start off with a couple of things. Obviously, one of the big questions that people have is, what is the reliability of what we have today? Well, in order to really talk about that, we had to have established the other things that we've discussed. The things like the New Testament being a historically reliable document, that it was written and circulated relatively soon after the events had occurred, that there's internal evidence that shows that it was not a bunch of collusion. We've talked a little bit about that. We'll bring that up again a little bit tonight. The fact that it had many copies that had been circulated. And then, of course, one of the great pieces of evidence is that within the first, well, the end of the first century and into the early second century, we have examples of people copying or quoting sections, large sections of Scripture from the New Testament. And that's very helpful. And then, of course, we talked a little bit about the archaeological evidence that confirms the New Testament was reliable as we have it today, and those areas that we can check, things like people, places, and events, the New Testament is very accurate in that regard. So really the question becomes, well, what assurance do we have that what we have today in the form of the New Testament is that which was penned by its original authors? In other words, how do we know that this isn't what we have today isn't just the result of a few hundred, a couple thousand years of the telephone game? How do we know? How do we know that what Luke originally intended to write or what Paul originally wrote, that that is what we have today? And that is a question that is constantly on the minds of anybody who's a skeptic. And I actually welcome discussions with skeptics because it shows that they're thinking. I will also say that not all Bible translations are equal. I think most of you know that. There's some that are good for general idea stuff, good for kids, kind of get them through the basics. But if you are an adult and you are using the NIV, you need to throw it out. And I'm serious. If you need a new Bible, come to me. I will buy you one. The NIV is awful. Anybody that's ever sat down and studied with somebody and they use the NIV as their only source, it's amazing how many times you have to correct stuff. And while that's not in there, well, why isn't it in there? Well, because it's nearly inspired. I don't. That's what NIV stands for. Did you know that? It stands for nearly inspired version. Oh, okay. No, that's. It's a joke, but not all Bible translations are equal. There are a lot of bad ones. So stick to something that is a word for word translation. I have a whole bunch of information on that. If you want to talk about that, I can bore you to death with it. But not all translations are equal. I like the New American Standard. I like the New King James. I still prefer New American Standard. If nothing else, it's because of what I've always used. There's some really good literal translations. One of them, I think, is probably my favorite literal is the Rotherhams. I think Rotherham did probably the best job of what I've seen. I've certainly not looked at every single translation, but from what I've seen, it's the best translation and the most accurate in terms of the way that the words are used throughout the text. So just keep that in mind. You'll often run into folk who their experience of what the New Testament is based on what they see on the internet or on a Bible that somebody gave them. And usually they're poor versions, to be perfectly honest. So anyway, just as a side note. So to begin this discussion, there's a couple of important terms that we need to understand. One of those is autograph, and the other one is manuscript. If you look at manuscript, most of you will probably have, if you have a decent Bible that has some good footnotes or some good cross-references, you'll see an abbreviation that's MSS. And that is a reference to the word manuscript or manuscripts. That's the abbreviation for that. What a manuscript is a handwritten copy of an old document. That's what a manuscript is. The autograph is the original document written by its author. I talked about a little bit of an example of that with Mike Wojtaszewski, and he and I writing a letter back and forth. But the autographs are the ones that were originally written by the author. And God chose not to preserve these for us. And I think it was a very, very wise idea. I mean, obviously the Lord is wise, so it shouldn't surprise us that it was a wise idea. I think that the example that we can use from that and why the Lord didn't include it is from Jude 1. Let's just go ahead and go there. This is the scripture that I will generally use when folk ask me why we don't have the originals. And I use this example. Verse 9, Jude 1, verse 9. But Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." Now, I don't generally, it's part of a longer discussion, but the reality is that mankind has this desire to worship something, to idolize something. And I believe that this is the reason why the body of Moses was sought after by the devil. Why did he care? Well, because he could use it to distract people. He could have used the body of Moses as maybe a relic and buried in their churches. I'm sorry, that's the Catholic. That's what the Catholics did when they built their churches. Is they used what was called relics, and they used those to establish the holiness, quote unquote, of their congregations, of their churches. They would bury pieces, what they thought were pieces of a saint, quote unquote, like a bone, a finger bone, or an ankle bone, or yeah, I'm not kidding. That's how they established their churches during the early time in the Catholic Church. So you can see that same mentality being used in more modern times, which is again why I think the Lord chose not to keep them for us. So because we don't have the original autographs, the manuscripts that were penned by the authors, how do we know that there haven't been significant changes or errors made in the process of copying over the years? It's a legitimate question. Now, how do we know that there wasn't collusion? Or you know, what collusion is? It's basically like secret cooperation in order to deceive the recipients. Okay, collusion. It's secret cooperation. Okay. So, otherwise, Kevin, thank you. Known as a conspiracy theory, or never mind. So, how do we know that the original authors of the New Testament didn't just get together and decide to do this in order to maybe portray their own fame or to form some sort of cult that they could benefit from? Well, and then this is, of course, where what's called the bibliographic test comes in. And the bibliographic test is really applied to all ancient manuscripts when they're discovered. And that's the same test we're going to put towards the New Testament. So, but to understand what that means, let's talk a little bit about the bibliographic test. This test is applied, as I mentioned, to all ancient historical documents and several documents that you may or may not heard of. If you're a student of history, you'll probably have heard of these. If not, no big deal. Julius Caesar. Guys, anybody ever heard of Julius Caesar? Okay. How do you know he existed? Prove it. Prove to me that he existed. I'm waiting. Well, how do you know the history is right? Yeah, the History Channel told us all about it. Well, yeah, Wikipedia. Not very far removed from the source, right? Julius Caesar, he was an author. Obviously, he was a Caesar. He wrote a book called The Gallic Wars, or Commentaries on the Gallic War. It was published in around 58 to 48 BC. So that was a long time ago. Another good example, and we'll talk a little bit more about these in some detail here in just a bit, the Histories of Tacitus, very commonly referenced in historical studies. His particular period covered by his writings starts at the beginning of the year AD 69, so 6 months after the death of Nero, and it continues to the death of Domitian in 96. So he writes for about 27 years. Or he covers about that much period, and it was written about 100 to 110. He also wrote what was called the Annals of Tacitus, another very commonly used historical reference for the first century. It was kind of his final work, and it provides a key source for the modern understanding of the history of the Roman Empire, from the beginning of the reign of Tiberius in 14 to the end of the reign of Nero in 68. So there's many books written on the history of the Roman Empire. There's a couple of really good ones that I really like and really enjoy them. One of them, it's an audiobook. It's about 23 hours long. I love it. I'm a dork. I love it. I dig into this stuff. I find it so amazing and so interesting. But the only reason we know anything about this time period is because of what Tacitus did. Okay. His final work, the Annals, was written around 116. And then, of course, one other test we're going to put to it is the New Testament texts written between 35 and 98, to be very generous with the time frame. So in an effort to establish the likelihood that what copies we have to make sure that we understand the application of the bibliographic text. You don't have to necessarily remember all of these fancy terms or anything like that. Just remember the fact that there are ways of testing an ancient document. And we'll get to some of the details here in just a bit. So what we want to be able to prove, or what we want to be able to establish, is that what we have today are faithful representations of the originals and have come to us free of changes, errors, or collusion. That's what we're trying to prove. So there are four basic questions that are raised in the bibliographic test. Number one is, how many copies of the document in question are available? Why is the number of copies important? Well, it's so that you can compare them to one another. And obviously, the more copies you have of something from an ancient perspective, the better. And again, we live in a way that it's so easy to copy something. Just, you know, highlight it, control C, alt tab to a different one, control V, and you got a copy, right? Or press print and print and print, or keep, just try to print one and it doesn't work, and then you print a few more times and then it eventually works and you get 8 copies of it. That happens all the time. I can't tell you how many half copies of my notes I have. The thing is that we take it for granted. But if you think about it from the perspective of ancient times, making a copy of a document was a laborious process. I can't remember his... Oh, my goodness. There was a gentleman, an older gentleman, who used to sit in front. He's passed away. He lived with Dave Dobson. Do you remember his name? Michael Conover was the last name? Yeah. I don't know how many of you knew this, but he copied the New Testament by hand. I mean, the whole thing. Wrote it out by hand. It was thick. And when he was getting very ill near the end of his life, he gave it to me. And I'm like, I don't want this because I appreciate that, but I didn't want it because I didn't want to be responsible for it because I know how much effort went into it. So I bring this up because making a copy of a document today is very easy. Then it wasn't. You had to do it by hand. So the more copies we have of something written during that particular time frame, especially, is very useful in helping to show the authenticity of what we have today. One of the problems that you might encounter, though, is that if these copies that are available, if they are far removed by time and location, then the less accurate those copies or the less trustworthy those copies become. However, if you flip it on the other side of that coin, the closer they are to the events and to the location, collusion's pretty unlikely, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in some detail. So, and then another question that we need to ask, and remember there's four total questions that we want to ask in the bibliographic text. The first is, how many copies? The second, where were the copies found? The third is, what length of time passed between the original and the earliest copies? We've talked about that. We'll discuss that a little bit more. And then, of course, what variances exist between the copies? Here's the reality, is that you will often find, especially in ancient historical documents, you will find copies that come from relatively the same time frame, relatively the same place, but it's very rare to find copies of an ancient document that there isn't a single difference between them. And the New Testament is the same. Now, we'll talk about that, so don't freak out. But it's very rare to find 100% agreement between those copies. If there are significant differences, then it would not be possible to know what the original author wrote. Okay? But if the variances are few and minor, then the process of copying over the years has been faithful to the original. That's kind of the two sides of that coin. So the answers that we find when these questions are applied to the New Testament are pretty interesting. And then we're actually going to look at how the New Testament compares with other historical documents of antiquity. So when we look at the New Testament, I was going to do all the other books first and the number of copies, but I want to make sure and get you the important information first. How many copies of the New Testament manuscripts are available? That is a question that I want you to think about. Now, yeah, okay, let's do this. The Gallic Wars, Caesar's Gallic Wars. We'll do those first. Any idea, any guesses? This is an ancient document. Remember, it was written B.C., first century B.C. Any idea, any guesses how many copies of that particular reference there are? Ancient copies. Ancient within a couple hundred years. Less than 20? About 10. So I bring this up because there's 10 copies that we can show that are from a relatively close amount of time and relatively the same location and that match to certain degrees, and everything that we know about that time frame are based upon those 10 copies. Okay? And they're in Greek. How about the Annals of Tacitus? As I mentioned, it's a very commonly quoted and relied upon historical document. His annals, there are two copies. There's many others. Plato, heard of Plato? Not D-O-H, but T-O. Not the stuff you give to your brother after his first kids. Long story. There are 7 copies of Plato's earliest works, and they are from 900 to 1300 years, so 900 to 1300 years after the originals were supposedly written. And yet, we don't necessarily question whether or not they're written by Plato. Sophocles, there's about 100 copies of his works, also fairly removed. One of the probably most well-known is Homer's Iliad. It was written around 900 BC. The oldest copy is from 400 BC, so about 500 years. And there are 643 copies of the Iliad that are relatively the same time frame and location. So there are 643 copies of the Iliad. And these manuscripts, they agree 95% of the time. So there's a 5% difference between all of those 643 copies of the Iliad. Now, it's actually pretty impressive for an ancient historical document for us to have that many copies. It really is. 643. Anybody ever seen a book of the Iliad? It's many, 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 many pages. It's very thick. I think there's a copy of it in the library back here that is from my personal library, but I think there's a copy back there. It's very thick. So the fact that somebody copied it, 643 people probably copied it, that's pretty impressive because it's long, okay? So it's pretty impressive to have that many. Anybody ever heard of Aristotle, another ancient Greek philosopher? He wrote between 384 and 322 BC. The oldest copy that we have of Aristotle's works is dated AD 1100, which was 1400 years after he lived and died. The total number of his original language manuscripts is 49 of any one. That's the largest amount of any one of Aristotle's books or writings. So we have the Iliad at 643. That's the ancient document that has the largest number of copies that agree 95% of the time. How about the New Testament? So what language was the New Testament written in originally? Greek, right? Okay. There are 5,795 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. 5,795. That's 5,100 more than the Iliad, the next closest book in antiquity. But it doesn't stop there. There are over 8,000 copies of the New Testament in Latin. They were... Well, and then there's other languages that the Bible, that the New Testament was translated into, including Coptic, Syriac, Armenian, and Nubian. There are 9,300 copies in other languages. So in all, there are about 24,000 manuscripts in existence of the New Testament. 24,000. Yes, Larry?
What do they date those to? Because the letters were circulating in 100, 200 AD. So when did they actually start, here's your book?
When do they date which books to? The copies?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, where are they dating those to? Are they dating to like 400 AD?
The manuscripts that
yes,
are written?
Yes.
They vary. And some of the things that we discussed earlier, some of them were within 50 years of the original events, and some go out even further. So usually within 100 years of the originals.
So when you say copies of the New Testament, you don't mean the whole actual book?
We'll get into the details. Yep. Yep, good question. Okay. So there's 24,000 copies of the manuscripts in one way, shape, or form, which is an embarrassingly high number in terms of the comparing it to the Iliad and the Odyssey. So you think about it, just the number of Greek manuscript copies alone is far greater than those that are available for any other classic author. So the next question, and I'll get to your guys' question in just a moment, but where were these copies found? This becomes important. So these copies were found in various places around the Mediterranean. This gets really interesting. If you look into where we get our modern translations for our Bibles, there are three main sources, two primaries. One of them isn't used as much. But it's really interesting to see where we get this, what we have today, what sources of information that we have for those. I'm not going to get into all the details on that, but it's really pretty interesting. But these copies that I've mentioned were found in places like Egypt, not that far away, but fairly distant. Obviously, the Palestine area, Syria, Turkey, Greece, Italy, Rome, Ethiopia. I mean, that's getting further away. And so, why is this important? Why is it that we have these different this spread out area of where these original copies or where these manuscripts were found? Well, if you think about it, that would make collusion exceptionally difficult. It would be exceptionally difficult for somebody in Ethiopia to collude with somebody in, say, Greece about the writing of a document that they're just making up. It would be very difficult for somebody in two different locations, unless they had a copy of the original or a facsimile of the original in some way, to make copies of their own and get it right. So another question that we can ask in this is, well, what length of time passed between the original and the earliest copies? This is what Mike and Larry were asking. Well, if you remember, in one of the previous lessons, we talked about that several of the papyri fragments have been dated to within 50 to 100 years of the original events that had occurred. And since we have nearly complete Greek New Testaments, that were copied within 300 to 400 years of the events that had occurred. So remember, we have papyri fragments that go all the way back into the latter part of the first century. And these papyri fragments, when they compare them to the complete copies in Greek of the New Testament, they match. They're not mentioning different people, places, or events. They're not referencing authors that don't exist. Instead, they're able to prove or to show that the early fragments, 50 to 100 years after the events, were accurate when compared to the 300 to 400 year copies. So a couple of examples of that, of these complete Greek New Testament manuscripts. One of them is the Codex Sinaiticus, it was found near Sinai, what they think was Sinai. That one was approximately 322. Is what they dated it to. The Codex Alexandrius, which was found near Alexandria in Egypt, and the Codex Vaticanus, which is located in the Vatican in Rome. And no, it was not found in the Vatican. That's just where they put it, and that's what they named it. So you look at these early New Testament Greek manuscripts, and when you compare these with the manuscripts of various classical histories, you look at, for instance, Thucydides. He wrote 460 to 395 BC. He was a historian. He was a political philosopher, a general, and he wrote The History of the Peloponnesian War. This was written from his perspective. So it provides much of what we know about the 5th century war, 5th century BC war, between Sparta and Athens. So I'm sure you know, you've seen or heard of maybe that whole kind of deciding battle with 300 and, well, that's of course very, very Hollywoodized, but did happen. Well, most of what we know about that came from this guy. The earliest copy of his history is 1,300 years removed from the original. The work of Herodotus, or there's many ways to pronounce it, Herodotus, Herovitas, anyway. His history is 484 to 425 BC, called it the Histories of Herodotus. It is the record of his inquiry into the origins of the Greco-Persian Wars. He talks about other geographical and ethnographical information, basically the studies of the societies that were alive during that time frame, so on and so forth. Most of what we know about the history of ancient Greek culture comes from what Herodotus wrote. So how far removed is the information we have about from Herodotus from when the original events had occurred? About 1,350 years. How about Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars? As I mentioned, 58 to 50 BC. They described the military campaigns against several Gallic tribes. Basically, the Gallic area in modern times is France and Belgium. It is the most important historical source regarding that conflict. The earliest copies we have of it are 1,000 years removed. How about the Roman History of Livy? 350 years removed. And the earliest copy of that is only a fragment. The Histories of Tacitus, 750 years. The Annals of Tacitus, 950 years. And there are only two manuscripts. I realize I've thrown a lot of dates and names at you, but here's the reality is that the New Testament, in terms of its reliability and the number of copies that are available, is astounding. I remember the first time I heard Mr. Simpson say that the Bible is one of the greatest miracles that we have in our hands. I thought about it, and I thought, man, he's right. This is a fantastic miracle that we have this book in our hands and that we can compare it to some of the earliest copies or manuscripts. Mike.
So you said you're throwing out a bunch of numbers and a lot of information. To that I say amen. It is a lot of information. What's the source? Because I can see being in a discussion like this, and you throw out, did you know there's 5,000 manuscripts of the Greek New Testament? Did you know that it happened within 300? Mm-hmm. What's the source of that information?
There isn't a singular source. It's going to be a variety of sources from academic as well as, well, not just academic in terms of like universities and whatnot, but other historical and archaeological foundations that have done the work on them. I don't have them listed. I've never thought about that from that particular question. It's a good question. Right. Well, and I would go back, well, how do you know that Julius Caesar existed? And why are we trusting that? So that is a good question. Most of the sources there, I can't say most. I would say all the sources are trustworthy. It's still stuff that you can go back to. And you can look into their research. It's not hidden from public view. So as a matter of fact, it's provided just about free everywhere you go if you're looking for the information.
When you also say it's a probability and statistics thing, I mean, you know, if I only got a couple copies, well, I guess they could have made that stuff up, you know. Yeah. But when you start getting, you know, numbers, 5,000, 10,000, and like you had said, you know, that statistically it's like that's not a happy accident.
Mm, yeah, very true. And the reality of having 24,000 copies of the New Testament in some way, shape, or form is pretty, again, pretty remarkable. So the next question becomes, well, what are the variances between the copies of the New Testament? And this is one where people are usually going to kind of latch onto. They're going to try to say, well, yeah, but there's copies of it, but there's got to be significant differences between them. It is true that there are some variations between the many thousands of manuscripts available. Remember, I said about 24,000. It is true that there are some variations between them. But the vast majority are very minor. Okay, I'll give you an example. This is one that hopefully you understand. Okay. I admit that's not the way that letter is written, but it's all right. What's that word? No, it's not. That's two F's. Right. This is how the Congress, I mean, obviously a lot more eloquently and beautifully than that, was Congress was written with these letters that look like F's to us. So in a more modern translation, of course, you're going to have it scribbled out, and it's going to have two S's. This is some of the variation that's between some of the copies. Does it change the meaning of the text? No. The vast majority of the changes that or the differences that you will find, there are differences in spelling, differences in phraseology, etc. Modern translations, and if you have a good modern translation, they'll often note the differences in footnotes. And the footnotes generally are point out that the difference is very, very minor. We can confidently affirm, okay, before I ask the question, remember I talked about how in ancient manuscripts, some of the ones that we have, and we're talking about the Iliad, that they were the 643 manuscripts that we have, there was a 95% agreement between all 643 copies of the Iliad. Okay, so the math guy over there, Larry, brought up statistics. Now, statistically speaking, if you increase a sample size, especially you go from 643 to, let's just take the Greek manuscripts, 5,795, is there going to be a larger variance difference or a smaller variance or difference between the texts? Statistically speaking, it should be larger, should be much larger, should be 10 times larger. Well, out of those thousands of copies, tens of thousands of copies of that we have in the New Testament, we can confidently affirm that we have 999 of 1,000 of the original Greek New Testament words intact. In other words, the remaining 0.1% pertains to inconsequential details. So we increased, just looking at the Greek manuscripts, the number of copies by 10 times, and we went from having approximately a 5% agreement with the Iliad to having a 99.9% agreement in the New Testament with 10 times the number of copies. Even then, it can be stated that there is no fundamental doctrine of the Christian faith that rests on a disputed reading. It cannot be too strongly asserted that the substance of the text of the Bible in the New Testament is certain. The New Testament is especially true in that regard. That actually reminds me of another book that I didn't bring because it's electronic. It's F.F. Bruce. That's the author. He says he asked the question. I think the book is titled "Is the New Testament Reliable?" I think that's what the title of the book is. But he mentions that, and then others like Sir Frederick Kenyon. He was the gentleman who made that quote about the fundamental doctrine of the Christian faith. Guys, it is truly amazing. From an archaeological, historical perspective, to find something, that many copies that matches that closely, is truly a nothing short of a miracle. So, any questions before I move on to the next section? Mr. Taylor, sitting all the way in the back.
So with regard to text and thing of that nature, what about the argument on the majority text versus the Texas Rexus? Or should we really trust anything that came from the Latin and then back to the translation? What are the insights on that?
Like you're talking, for instance, when Jerome translated the Latin Vulgate and those kinds of questions.
Texas Rexus, right. Or the King James or whatever.
A lot of the changes that you're going to see in those, that, for instance, Jerome was in the Latin Vulgate, made some contextual changes, didn't change the overall meaning of the text itself, but used words that were more appropriate for who was paying him to translate them. So, for instance, King James Version, if anybody has a King James Version, you know the word that is in the King James, in the book of Acts, says Easter. That word is not in the text. It's right Passover. So a lot of the changes that you're going to see with things like that are going to be contextual things like that based upon the author or the translator's perspective. So when we compare those things to some of the earlier texts, the Greek manuscripts, for instance, we can easily see the differences between those and make the corrections as necessary.
So I've studied with some guys, and they only want to use one version, so you got to kind of like know all the versions to, because you really can't pin somebody down on going to the most literal, then they're not going to really, they want to have Easter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And they'll probably try to find a way to say, well, the copies found in the Mediterranean are less accurate than the ones that are housed in Rome, and then And really what it comes down to, in my opinion, is it comes down to the honesty of this person. And that's a whole other discussion.
Well, that's why I got denominations anyway, right? Because we've widened the path a little bit to let these guys in, and it doesn't quite fit if we use this.
Yep. So a lot of the things that a lot of the questions that you'll run into when it gets down to stuff like that, it deals with what's called textual criticism. And it's not an area that I've spent a lot of time researching, but... The basic point is that most of the time when you get into that deep textual criticism stuff and hermeneutics and so on and so forth, the desire that the person has that's bringing that up is not to let the scripture say what it says, but to have it say what they want it to say. That's what it is most of the time. Now, I haven't studied with every person like that, and very rarely do I come across somebody that has that level of knowledge. But the couple of times that I have... They come from a very, very denominationalistic perspective. So the next section that I want to talk about, I'll just introduce it tonight, and then we'll wrap up because I don't want to have to back up next week, is basically how do we know that the 27 books of the New Testament that we have are the right ones? If you ask the average person that knows even a smidgen about the Bible or about where it came from, what are they going to say? What's that? Okay, they might mention the Dead Sea Scrolls, but specifically the New Testament. Who made the New Testament canon? The Catholic Church. That's what they'll say. Yep. So now what? I mean, you can't. You can't really deny that. I mean, Council of Nicaea, right? Everybody brings that one up. Of course, there were other councils. So how do you combat that? And we'll talk about it next week. Kevin's going to have a heart attack. It's all right, bud. But that's a very common argument, isn't it, Kevin? Okay. Yeah. So why is it that we use the copy that we have today? And why are the other books excluded? And which other books were they? How many copies of the other books were there? And why are they excluded? So we'll talk about all that next week. And most likely, I will be done next week. Any closing comments or questions? Okay. All right. Thank you guys for your time.